This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible. Audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
Random House Audio presents Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder, by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Read for you by Joe Ackman. This audio production includes a PDF file of the graphics referred to in this book. Prologue. 1. How to Love the Wind. Wind extinguishes a candle and energizes fire. Likewise with randomness, uncertainty, chaos. You want to use them, not hide from them. You want to be the fire and wish for the wind. This summarizes this author's non-meek attitude to randomness and uncertainty. We just don't want to just survive uncertainty, to just about make it. We want to survive uncertainty and, in addition, like a certain class of aggressive Roman Stoics, have the last word. The mission is how to domesticate, even dominate, even conquer the unseen, the opaque, and the inexplicable. How? 2. The Anti-Fragile. Some things benefit from shocks. They thrive and grow when exposed to volatility, randomness, disorder, and stressors, and love, adventure, risk, and uncertainty. Yet, in spite of the ubiquity of the phenomenon, there is no word for the exact opposite of fragile. Let us call it anti-fragile. Anti-fragility is beyond resilience or robustness. The resilient resists shocks and stays the same. The anti-fragile gets better. This property is behind everything that has changed with time, evolution, culture, ideas, revolutions, political systems, technological innovation, cultural and economic success, corporate survival, good recipes, say chicken soup or steak tartare with a drop of cognac, the rise of cities, cultures, legal systems, equatorial forests, bacterial resistance, even our own existence as a species on this planet. And anti-fragility determines the boundary between what is living and organic, or complex, say, the human body, and what is inert, say, a physical object like the stapler on your desk. The anti-fragile loves randomness and uncertainty, which also means, crucially, a love of errors, a certain class of errors. Anti-fragility has a singular property of allowing us to deal with the unknown, to do things without understanding them, and do them well. Let me be more aggressive. We are largely better at doing than we are at thinking, thanks to anti-fragility. I'd rather be dumb and anti-fragile than extremely smart and fragile any time. It is easy to see things around us that like a measure of stressors and volatility. Economic systems, your body, your nutrition. Diabetes and Alzheimer's disease seem to come largely from a lack of randomness in feeding and the absence of the stressor of occasional starvation. Your psyche. There are even financial contracts that are anti-fragile. They are explicitly designed to benefit from market volatility. Anti-fragility makes us understand fragility better. Just as we cannot improve health without reducing disease, or increase wealth without first decreasing losses, anti-fragility and fragility are degrees on a spectrum. Non-prediction. By grasping the mechanisms of anti-fragility, we can build a systematic and broad guide to non-predictive decision-making under uncertainty in business, politics, medicine, and life in general, anywhere the unknown preponderates, any situation in which there is randomness, unpredictability, opacity, or incomplete understanding of things. It is far easier to figure out if something is fragile than to predict the occurrence of an event that may harm it. Fragility can be measured. Risk is not measurable, outside of casinos or the minds of people who call themselves risk experts. This provides a solution to what I've called the black swan problem, the impossibility of calculating the risks of consequential rare events and predicting their occurrence. Sensitivity to harm from volatility is tractable, more so than forecasting the event that would cause the harm. So we propose to stand our current approaches to prediction, prognostication, and risk management on their heads. In every domain or area of application, we propose rules for moving from the fragile toward the anti-fragile through reduction of fragility or harnessing anti-fragility. And we can almost always detect anti-fragility and fragility using a simple test of asymmetry. Anything that has more upside than downside from random events or certain shocks is anti-fragile. The reverse is fragile. Deprivation of anti-fragility. Crucially, if anti-fragility is the property of all those natural and complex systems that have survived, depriving these systems of volatility, randomness, and stressors will harm them. They will weaken, die, or blow up. We have been fragilizing the economy, our health, political life, education, almost everything, by suppressing randomness and volatility. Just as spending a month in bed, preferably with an unabridged version of War and Peace and access to The Sopranos' entire 86 episodes, leads to muscle atrophy. Complex systems are weakened, even killed, when deprived of stressors. Much of our modern structured world has been harming us with top-down policies and contraptions, dubbed Soviet Harvard delusions in the book, which do precisely this, an insult to the anti-fragility of systems. This is the tragedy of modernity. As with neurotically overprotective parents, those trying to help are often hurting us the most. If about everything top-down fragilizes and blocks anti-fragility and growth, everything bottom-up thrives under the right amount of stress and disorder. The process of discovery, or innovation, or technological progress itself depends on anti-fragile tinkering, aggressive risk-bearing rather than formal education. Upside at the expense of others. Which brings us to the largest fragilizer of society and greatest generator of crises, absence of skin in the game. Some become anti-fragile at the expense of others by getting the upside or gains from volatility, variations, and disorder, and exposing others to the downside risks of losses or harm. And such anti-fragility at the cost of fragility of others is hidden. Given the blindness to anti-fragility by the Soviet Harvard intellectual circles, this asymmetry is rarely identified and so far never taught. Further, as we discovered during the financial crisis that started in 2008, these blow-up risks to others are easily concealed owing to the growing complexity of modern institutions and political affairs. While in the past, people of rank or status were those and only those who took risks, who had the downside for their actions, and heroes were those who did so for the sake of others, today the exact reverse is taking place. We are witnessing the rise of a new class of inverse heroes, that is, bureaucrats, bankers, Davos-attending members of the IAND, International Association of Name Droppers, and academics with too much power and no real downside and/or accountability. They game the system while citizens pay the price. At no point in history have so many non-risk-takers, that is, those with no personal exposure, exerted so much control. The chief ethical rule is the following: thou shalt not have anti-fragility at the expense of the fragility of others. 3. The antidote to the black swan. I want to live happily in a world I don't understand. Black swans, capitalize, are large-scale, unpredictable, and irregular events of massive consequence, unpredicted by a certain observer, and such unpredictor is generally called the turkey when he is both surprised and harmed by these events. I have made the claim that most of history comes from black swan events, while we worry about fine-tuning our understanding of the ordinary, and hence develop models, theories, or representations that cannot possibly track them or measure the possibility of these shocks. Black swans hijack our brains, making us feel we sort of or almost predicted them, because they are retrospectively explainable. We don't realize the role of these swans in life because of this illusion of predictability. Life is more, a lot more, labyrinthine than shown in our memory. Our minds are in the business of turning history into something smooth and linear, which makes us underestimate randomness. But when we see it, we fear it and overreact. Because of this fear and thirst for order, some human systems, by disrupting the invisible or not-so-visible logic of things, tend to be exposed to harm from black swans and almost never get any benefit. You get pseudo-order when you seek order. You only get a measure of order and control when you embrace randomness. Complex systems are full of interdependencies, hard to detect, and non-linear responses. Non-linear means that when you double the dose of, say, a medication, or when you double the number of employees in a factory, you don't get twice the initial effect, but rather a lot more or a lot less. 2 weekends in Philadelphia are not twice as pleasant as a single one. I've tried. When the response is plotted on a graph, it does not show as a straight line, linear, rather as a curve. In such environment, simple causal associations are misplaced. It is hard to see how things work by looking at single parts. Man-made complex systems tend to develop cascades and runaway chains of reactions that decrease, even eliminate, predictability and cause outsized events. So the modern world may be increasing in technological knowledge, but, paradoxically, it is making things a lot more unpredictable. Now, for reasons that have to do with the increase of the artificial, the move away from ancestral and natural models, and the loss in robustness owing to complications in the design of everything, the role of black swans is increasing. Further, we are victims to a new disease called in this book Neomania that makes us build black swan vulnerable systems. Progress. An annoying aspect of the black swan problem, in fact, the central and largely missed point, is that the odds of rare events are simply not computable. We know a lot less about 100-year floods than 5-year floods. Model error swells when it comes to small probabilities. The rarer the event, the less tractable, and the less we know about how frequent its occurrence. Yet, the rarer the event, the more confident these scientists involved in predicting, modeling, and using PowerPoint in conferences with equations in multicolor background have become. It is of great help that Mother Nature, thanks to its anti-fragility, is the best expert at rare events and the best manager of black swans. In its billions of years, it succeeded in getting here without much command and control instruction from an Ivy League-educated director nominated by a search committee. Antifragility is not just the antidote to the black swan. Understanding it makes us less intellectually fearful in accepting the role of these events as necessary for history, technology, knowledge, everything. Robust is not robust enough. Consider that Mother Nature is not just safe. It is aggressive in destroying and replacing, in selecting and reshuffling. When it comes to random events, robust is certainly not good enough. In the long run, everything with the most minute vulnerability breaks, given the ruthlessness of time. Yet our planet has been around for perhaps 4 billion years, and convincingly, robustness can't just be it. You need perfect robustness for a crack not to end up crashing the system. Given the unattainability of perfect robustness, we need a mechanism by which the system regenerates itself continuously by using, rather than suffering from, random events, unpredictable shocks, stressors, and volatility. The anti-fragile gains from prediction errors in the long run. If you follow this idea to its conclusion, then many things that gain from randomness should be dominating the world today, and things that are hurt by it should be gone. Well, this turns out to be the case. We have the illusion that the world functions thanks to program design, university research, and bureaucratic funding, but there is compelling, very compelling evidence to show that this is an illusion, the illusion I call lecturing birds how to fly. Technology is the result of anti-fragility, exploited by risk-takers in the form of tinkering and trial and error, with nerd-driven design confined to the backstage. Engineers and tinkerers develop things while history books are written by academics. We will have to refine historical interpretations of growth, innovation, and many such things. On the measurability of some things. Fragility is quite measurable, risk not so at all, particularly risk associated with rare events. Outside of casinos and some narrowly defined areas, such as man-made situations and constructions. I said that we can estimate, even measure, fragility and anti-fragility. While we cannot calculate risks and probabilities of shocks and rare events, no matter how sophisticated we get, risk management as practiced is the study of an event taking place in the future, and only some economists and other lunatics can claim, against experience, to measure the future incidence of these rare events, with suckers listening to them, against experience and the track record of such claims. But fragility and anti-fragility are part of the current property of an object, a coffee table, a company, an industry, a country, a political system. We can detect fragility, see it, even in many cases measure it, or at least measure comparative fragility with a small error, while comparisons of risk have been so far unreliable. You cannot say with any reliability that a certain remote event or shock is more likely than another, unless you enjoy deceiving yourself. But you can state with a lot more confidence that an object or a structure is more fragile than another should a certain event happen. You can easily tell that your grandmother is more fragile to abrupt changes in temperature than you, that some military dictatorship is more fragile than Switzerland should political change happen, that a bank is more fragile than another should a crisis occur, or that a poorly built modern building is more fragile than the Cathedral of Chartres should an earthquake happen. And, centrally, you can even make the prediction of which one will last longer. Instead of a discussion of risk, which is both predictive and sissy, I advocate the notion of fragility, which is not predictive, and, unlike risk, has an interesting word that can describe its functional opposite, the non-sissy concept of anti-fragility. To measure anti-fragility, there is a philosopher's stone-like recipe using a compact and simplified rule that allows us to identify it across domains, from health to the construction of societies. We have been unconsciously exploiting anti-fragility in practical life and consciously rejecting it, particularly in intellectual life. The Fragilista. Our idea is to avoid interference with things we don't understand. Well, some people are prone to the opposite. The Fragilista belongs to that category of persons who are usually in suit and tie, often on Fridays. He faces your jokes with icy solemnity and tends to develop back problems early in life from sitting at a desk, riding airplanes, and studying newspapers. He is often involved in a strange ritual, something commonly called a meeting. Now, in addition to these traits, he defaults to thinking that what he doesn't see is not there, or what he does not understand does not exist. At the core, he tends to mistake the unknown for the non-existent. The Fragilista falls for the Soviet Harvard delusion, the unscientific overestimation of the reach of scientific knowledge. Because of such delusion, he is what is called a naive rationalist, a rationalizer, or sometimes just a rationalist, in the sense that he believes that the reasons behind things are automatically accessible to him. And let us not confuse rationalizing with rational. The two are almost always exact opposites. Outside of physics, and generally in complex domains, the reasons behind things have had a tendency to make themselves less obvious to us, and even less to the Fragilista. This property of natural things not to advertise themselves in a user's manual are, alas, not much of a hindrance. Some Fragilistas will get together to write the user's manual themselves, thanks to their definition of science. So, thanks to the Fragilista, modern culture has been increasingly building blindness to the mysterious, the impenetrable, what Nietzsche called the Dionysian in life. Or to translate Nietzsche into the less poetic but no less insightful Brooklyn vernacular, this is what our character Fat Tony calls a sucker game. In short, the Fragilista, medical, economic, social planning, is one who makes you engage in policies and actions, all artificial, in which the benefits are small and visible, and the side effects potentially severe and invisible. There is the medical Fragilista who over-intervenes in denying the body's natural ability to heal and gives you medications with potentially very severe side effects, the policy fragilista, the interventionist social planner, who mistakes the economy for a washing machine that continuously needs fixing by him and blows it up. The psychiatric fragilista who medicates children to improve their intellectual and emotional life. The soccer mom fragilista. The financial fragilista who makes people use risk models that destroy the banking system, then uses them again. The military fragilista who disturbs complex systems. The predictor fragilista who encourages you to take more risks, and many more. Hayek did not take his idea about organic price formation into risk and fragility. For Hayek, bureaucrats were inefficient, not fragilistas. This discussion starts with fragility and anti-fragility, and gets us as a side discussion into organic price formation. Indeed, the political discourse is lacking a concept. Politicians in their speeches, goals, and promises aim at the timid concepts of resilience, solidity, not anti-fragility, and in the process are stifling the mechanisms of growth and evolution. We didn't get where we are thanks to the sissy notion of resilience. And what's worse, we didn't get where we are today thanks to policymakers, but thanks to the appetite for risks and errors of a certain class of people we need to encourage, protect, and respect. Where simple is more sophisticated. A complex system, contrary to what people believe, does not require complicated systems and regulations and intricate policies. The simpler, the better. Complications lead to multiplicative chains of unanticipated effects. Because of opacity, an intervention leads to unforeseen consequences, followed by apologies about the unforeseen aspect of the consequences, then to another intervention to correct the secondary effects, leading to an explosive series of branching unforeseen responses, each one worse than the preceding one. Yet simplicity has been difficult to implement in modern life because it is against the spirit of a certain brand of people who seek sophistication so they can justify their profession. Less is more, and usually more effective. Thus, I will produce a small number of tricks, directives, and interdicts, how to live in a world we don't understand, or, rather, how to not be afraid to work with things we patently don't understand, and, more principally, in what manner we should work with these. Or, even better, how to dare to look our ignorance in the face and not be ashamed of being human, be aggressively and proudly human. But that may require some structural changes. What I propose is a roadmap to modify our man-made systems to let the simple and natural take their course. But simplicity is not so simple to attain. Steve Jobs figured out that you have to work hard to get your thinking clean to make it simple. The Arabs have an expression for trenchant prose: no skill to understand it, mastery to write it. Heuristics are simplified rules of thumb that make things simple and easy to implement. But their main advantage is that the user knows that they are not perfect, just expedient, and is therefore less fooled by their powers. They become dangerous when we forget that. 4. This book. The journey to this idea of anti-fragility was, if anything, non-linear. I suddenly realized one day that fragility, which had been lacking a technical definition, could be expressed as what does not like volatility, and that what does not like volatility does not like randomness, uncertainty, disorder, errors, stressors, etc. Think of anything fragile, say, objects in your living room such as the glass frame, the television set, or, even better, the china in the cupboards. If you label them fragile, then you necessarily want them to be left alone in peace, quiet, order, and predictability. A fragile object would not possibly benefit from an earthquake or the visit of your hyperactive nephew. Further, everything that does not like volatility does not like stressors, harm, chaos, events, disorder, unforeseen consequences, uncertainty, and critically, time. And anti-fragility flows, sort of, from this explicit definition of fragility. It likes volatility at all. It also likes time. And there is a powerful and helpful link to nonlinearity. Everything nonlinear in response is either fragile or antifragile to a certain source of randomness. The strangest thing is that this obvious property that anything fragile hates volatility, and vice versa, has been sitting completely outside the scientific and philosophical discourse. Completely. And the study of the sensitivity of things to volatility is the strange business specialty in which I spent most of my adult life. 2 decades. I know it is a strange specialty. I promise to explain later. My focus in that profession has been on identifying items that love volatility or hate volatility. So all I had to do was expand the ideas from the financial domain in which I had been focused to the broader notion of decision-making under uncertainty across various fields, from political science to medicine to dinner plans. The technical term I used for hates volatility was short vega or short gamma, meaning harmed should volatility increase, and long vega or long gamma for things that benefit. In the rest of the book, we will use short and long to describe negative and positive exposures, respectively. It is critical that I never believed in our ability to forecast volatility, as I just focused on how things react to it. And in that strange profession of people who work with volatility, there were 2 types. First category, academics, report writers and commentators who study future events and write books and papers. And second category, practitioners who, instead of studying future events, try to understand how things react to volatility. But practitioners are usually too busy practicing to write books, articles, papers, speeches, equations, theories, and get honored by highly constipated and honorable members of academies. The difference between the 2 categories is central. As we saw, it is much easier to understand if something is harmed by volatility, hence fragile, than try to forecast harmful events, such as these oversized black swans. But only practitioners, or people who do things, tend to spontaneously get the point. The rather happy disorder family. 1 technical comment. We keep saying that fragility and antifragility mean potential gain or harm from exposure to something related to volatility. What is that something? Simply, membership in the extended disorder family. The extended disorder family, or cluster. 1. Uncertainty. 2. Variability. 3. Imperfect, incomplete knowledge. 4. Chance. 5. Chaos. 6. Volatility. 7. Disorder. 8. Entropy. 9. Time. 10. The unknown. 11. Randomness. 12. Turmoil. 13. Stressor. 14. Error. 15. Dispersion of outcomes. 16. Unknowledge. It happens that uncertainty, disorder, and the unknown are completely equivalent in their effect. Antifragile systems benefit, to some degree, from, and the fragile is penalized by, almost all of them. Even if you have to find them in separate buildings of the university campuses and some philosophaster who has never taken real risks in his life, or worse, never had a life, would inform you that they are clearly not the same thing. Why item 9, time? Time is functionally similar to volatility. The more time, the more events, the more disorder. Consider that if you can suffer limited harm and are antifragile to small errors, time brings the kind of errors or reverse errors that end up benefiting you. This is simply what your grandmother calls experience. The fragile breaks with time. Only 1 book. This makes this book my central work. I've had only 1 master idea, each time taken to its next step. The last step, this book, being more like a big jump. I am reconnected to my practical self, my soul of a practitioner, as this is a merger of my entire history as practitioner and volatility specialist, combined with my intellectual and philosophical interests in randomness and uncertainty, which had previously taken separate paths. My writings are not standalone essays on specific topics with beginnings, ends, and expiration dates. Rather, they are non-overlapping chapters from that central idea, a main corpus focused on uncertainty, randomness, probability, disorder, and what to do in a world we don't understand, a world with unseen elements and properties, the random and the complex, that is, decision-making under opacity. The corpus is called Incerto and is constituted, so far, of a trilogy plus philosophical and technical addenda. The rule is that the distance between a random chapter of one book, say, Antifragile, and another random chapter of another, say, Fooled by Randomness, should be similar to the one between chapters of a long book. The rule allows the corpus to cross domains by shifting across science, philosophy, business, psychology, literature, and autobiographical segments without lapsing into promiscuity. So the relationship of this book to the Black Swan would be as follows. In spite of the chronology and the fact that this book takes the Black Swan idea to its natural and prescriptive conclusion, Antifragile would be the main volume and the Black Swan its backup of sorts, and a theoretical one, perhaps even its junior appendix. Why? Because the Black Swan and its predecessor, Fooled by Randomness, were written to convince us of a dire situation and worked hard at it. This one starts from the position that one does not need convincing that A, black swans dominate society and history, and people, because of ex post rationalization, think themselves capable of understanding them. B, as a consequence, we don't quite know what's going on, particularly under severe non-linearities, so we can get to practical business right away. No guts, no belief. To accord with the practitioner's ethos, the rule in this book is as follows. I eat my own cooking. I have only written, in every line I have composed in my professional life, about things I have done, and the risks I have recommended that others take or avoid were risks I have been taking or avoiding myself. I will be the first to be hurt if I am wrong. When I warned about the fragility of the banking system in the Black Swan, I was betting on its collapse, particularly when my message went unheeded. Otherwise, I felt it would not have been ethical to write about it. That personal stricture applies to every domain, including medicine, technical innovation, and simple matters in life. It does not mean that one's personal experiences constitute a sufficient sample to derive a conclusion about an idea. It is just that one's personal experience gives the stamp of authenticity and sincerity of opinion. Experience is devoid of the cherry-picking that we find in studies, particularly those called observational, ones in which the researcher finds past patterns and, thanks to the sheer amount of data, can therefore fall into the trap of an invented narrative. Further, in writing, I feel corrupt and unethical if I have to look up a subject in a library as part of the writing itself. This acts as a filter. It is the only filter. If the subject is not interesting enough for me to look it up independently, for my own curiosity or purposes, and I have not done so before, then I should not be writing about it at all, period. It does not mean that libraries, physical and virtual, are not acceptable. It means that they should not be the source of any idea. Students pay to write essays on topics for which they have to derive knowledge from a library as a self-enhancement exercise. A professional who is compensated to write and is taken seriously by others should use a more potent filter. Only distilled ideas, ones that sit in us for a long time, are acceptable, and those that come from reality. It is time to revive the not well-known philosophical notion of doxastic commitment, a class of beliefs that go beyond talk and to which we are committed enough to take personal risks. If you see something, modernity has replaced ethics with legalese, and the law can be gamed with a good lawyer. So I will expose the transfer of fragility, or rather the theft of anti-fragility, by people arbitraging the system. These people will be named by name. Poets and painters are free, liberi poeti et pictoris, and there are severe moral imperatives that come with such freedom. First ethical rule. If you see fraud and do not say fraud, you are a fraud. Just as being nice to the arrogant is no better than being arrogant toward the nice, being accommodating toward anyone committing a nefarious action condones it. Further, many writers and scholars speak in private, say, after half a bottle of wine, differently from the way they do in print. Their writing is certifiably fake. Fake. And many of the problems of society come from the argument, other people are doing it. So if I call someone a dangerous, ethically challenged fragilista in private after the third glass of Lebanese wine, white, I will be obligated to do so here. Calling people and institutions fraudulent in print when they are not yet called so by others carries a cost, but it is too small to be a deterrent. After the mathematical scientist Benoit Mandelbrot read The Galleys of the Black Swan, a book dedicated to him, he called me and quietly said, "In what language should I say good luck to you?" I did not need any luck, it turned out. I was anti-fragile to all manner of attacks. The more attacks I got from the Central Fragilista delegation, the more my message spread as it drove people to examine my arguments. I am now ashamed of not having gone further in calling a spade a spade. Compromising is condoning. The only modern dictum I follow is one by George Santayana. A man is morally free when he judges the world and judges other men with uncompromising sincerity. This is not just an aim, but an obligation. Defossilizing things. Second ethical point. I am obligated to submit myself to the scientific process simply because I require it from others, but no more than that. When I read empirical claims in medicine or other sciences, I like these claims to go through the peer review mechanism, a fact-checking of sorts, an examination of the rigor of the approach. Logical statements, or those backed by mathematical reasoning, on the other hand, do not require such a mechanism. They can and must stand on their own legs. So I publish technical footnotes for these books and specialized in academic outlets, and nothing more, and limit them to statements that require proofs or more elaborate technical arguments. But for the sake of authenticity and to avoid careerism, the debasing of knowledge by turning it into a competitive sport, I ban myself from publishing anything outside of these footnotes. After more than 20 years as a transactional trader and businessman in what I called the strange profession, I tried what one calls an academic career. And I have something to report. Actually, that was the driver behind this idea of anti-fragility in life, and the dichotomy between the natural and the alienation of the unnatural. Commerce is fun, thrilling, lively, and natural. Academia, as currently professionalized, is none of these. And for those who think that academia is quieter and an emotionally relaxing transition after the volatile and risk-taking business life, a surprise. When in action, new problems and scares emerge every day to displace and eliminate the previous day's headaches, resentments, and conflicts. A nail displaces another nail with astonishing variety. But academics, particularly in social science, seem to distrust each other. They live in petty obsessions, envy, and icy cold hatreds, with small snubs developing into grudges, fossilized over time in the loneliness of the transaction with a computer screen and the immutability of their environment, not to mention a level of envy I have almost never seen in business. My experience is that money and transactions purify relations. Ideas and abstract matters like recognition and credit warp them, creating an atmosphere of perpetual rivalry. I grew to find people greedy for credentials nauseating, repulsive, and untrustworthy. Commerce, business, Levantine souks, though not large-scale markets and corporations, are activities and places that bring out the best in people, making most of them forgiving, honest, loving, trusting, and open-minded. As a member of the Christian minority in the Near East, I can vouch that commerce, particularly small commerce, is the door to tolerance. The only door, in my opinion, to any form of tolerance. It beats rationalizations and lectures. Like anti-fragile tinkering, mistakes are small and rapidly forgotten. I want to be happy to be human and be in an environment in which other people are in love with their fate. And never, until my brush with academia, did I think that that environment was a certain form of commerce combined with solitary scholarship. The biologist, writer, and libertarian economist Matt Ridley made me feel that it was truly the Phoenician trader in me, or more exactly, the Canaanite, that was the intellectual. Once again, please, no, it is not resilience. I am used to facing, at the end of a conference lecture, the question, "So what is the difference between robust and anti-fragile?" Or the more unenlightened and even more irritating, "Anti-fragile is resilient, no?" The reaction to my answer is usually, "Ah," with the look, "Why didn't you say that before?" Of course I had said that before. Even the initial referee of the scientific article I wrote on defining and detecting anti-fragility entirely missed the point, conflating anti-fragility and robustness, and that was the scientist who pored over my definitions. It is worth re-explaining the following. The robust or resilient is neither harmed nor helped by volatility and disorder, while the anti-fragile benefits from them. But it takes some effort for the concept to sink in. A lot of things people call robust or resilient are just robust or resilient. The other half are anti-fragile. 5. Organization. Anti-Fragile is composed of 7 books. Why books? The novelist and essayist Rolf de Belli's first reaction upon reading my Ethics and Via Negativa chapters, which I supplied separately, was that each should be a separate book and published as a short or medium-length essay. Someone in the business of summarizing books would have to write 4 or 5 separate descriptions. But I saw that they were not standalone essays at all. Each deals with the applications of a central idea, going either deeper or into different territories: evolution, politics, business innovation, scientific discovery, economics, ethics, epistemology, and general philosophy. So I call them books rather than sections or parts. Books to me are not expanded journal articles, but reading experiences, and the academics who tend to read in order to cite in their writing, rather than read for enjoyment, curiosity, or simply because they like to read, tend to be frustrated when they can't rapidly scan the text and summarize it in one sentence that connects it to some existing discourse in which they have been involved. Further, the essay is the polar opposite of the textbook, mixing autobiographical musings and parables with more philosophical and scientific investigations. I write about probability with my entire soul and my entire experiences in the risk-taking business. I write with my scars. Hence, my thought is inseparable from autobiography. The personal essay form is ideal for the topic of incertitude. The sequence is as follows. Graphic 1 of your PDF presents the triad as a table, a comprehensive map of the world along the fragility spectrum. Book 1, The Anti-Fragile, An Introduction, presents the new property and discusses evolution and the organic as the typical anti-fragile system. It also looks at the trade-off between the anti-fragility of the collective and the fragility of the individual. Book 2, Modernity and the Denial of Anti-Fragility, describes what happens when we starve systems, mostly political systems, of volatility. It discusses this invention called the nation-state, as well as the idea of harm done by the healer, someone who tries to help you and ends up harming you very badly. Book 3, A Non-Predictive View of the World, introduces Fat Tony and his intuitive detection of fragility, and presents the foundational asymmetry of things grounded in the writings of Seneca, the Roman philosopher and doer. Book 4, Optionality, Technology, and the Intelligence of Anti-Fragility, presents the mysterious property of the world by which a certain asymmetry is behind things rather than human intelligence, and how optionality drove us here. It is opposed to what I call the Soviet Harvard method, and Fat Tony argues with Socrates about how we do things one cannot quite explain. Book 5, The Non-Linear and the Non-Linear, Sick, is about the Philosopher's Stone and its opposite, how to turn lead into gold and gold into lead. 2 chapters constitute the central technical section, the plumbing of the book, mapping fragility as non-linearity, more specifically, convexity effects, and showing the edge coming from a certain class of convex strategies. Book 6, Via Negativa, shows the wisdom and effectiveness of subtraction over addition, acts of omission over acts of commission. This section introduces the notion of convexity effects. Of course, the first application is to medicine. I look at medicine only from an epistemological risk management approach, and it looks different from there. Book 7, The ethics of asymmetry grounds ethics in transfers of fragility, with one party getting the benefits and the other one the harm, and points out problems arising from absence of skin in the game. In addition, my website provides backup material with more elaborate arguments, all in the form of technical papers and notes. Don't mistake my illustrations and parables for proof. Remember, a personal essay is not a scientific document, but a scientific document is a scientific document. All these backup documents are gathered as a freely available electronic technical companion at fooledbyrandomness.com. Appendix: The Triad, or a Map of the World, and Things Along the Three Properties. Now we aim, after some work, to connect in the reader's mind with a single thread elements seemingly far apart, such as Cato the Elder, Nietzsche, Thales of Miletus, the potency of the system of city-states, the sustainability of artisans, the process of discovery, the one-sidedness of opacity, financial derivatives, antibiotic resistance, bottom-up systems, Socrates' invitation to over-rationalize, how to lecture birds, obsessive love, Darwinian evolution, the mathematical concept of Jensen's inequality, optionality and option theory, the idea of ancestral heuristics, the works of Joseph de Maistre and Edmund Burke, Wittgenstein's anti-rationalism, the fraudulent theories of the economics establishment, tinkering and bricolage, terrorism exacerbated by death of its members, an apologia for artisanal societies, the ethical flaws of the middle class, paleo-style workouts and nutrition, the idea of medical iatrogenics, the glorious notion of the magnificent megalopsychon, my obsession with the idea of convexity and my phobia of concavity, the late 2000s banking and economic crisis, the misunderstanding of redundancy, the difference between tourist and flaneur, etc. All in one single, and I am certain, simple thread. How? We can begin by seeing how things, just about anything that matters, can be mapped or classified into three categories, what I call the triad. Things come in triples. In the prologue, we saw that the idea is to focus on fragility rather than predicting and calculating future probabilities, and that fragility and anti-fragility come on a spectrum of varying degrees. The task here is to build a map of exposures. This is what is called real-world solution, though only academics and other non-real-world operators use the expression real-world solution instead of simply solution. The triad classifies items in three columns along the designation fragile, robust, anti-fragile. Recall that the fragile wants tranquility. The anti-fragile grows from disorder, and the robust doesn't care too much. The listener is invited to navigate the triad in graphic 1 of your included PDF to see how the ideas of the book apply across domains. Simply, in a given subject, when you discuss an item or a policy, the task is to find in which category of the triad one should put it and what to do in order to improve its condition. For example, the centralized nation-state is on the far left of the triad, squarely in the fragile category, and a decentralized system of city-states on the far right, in the anti-fragile one. By getting the characteristics of the latter, we can move away from the undesirable fragility of the large state, or look at errors. On the left, in the fragile category, the mistakes are rare and large when they occur, hence irreversible. To the right, the mistakes are small and benign, even reversible and quickly overcome. They are also rich in information. So a certain system of tinkering and trial and error would have the attributes of anti-fragility. If you want to become anti-fragile, put yourself in the situation loves mistakes to the right of hates mistakes by making these numerous and small in harm. We will call this process and approach the barbell strategy. Or take the health category. Adding is on the left, removing to the right. Removing medication or some other unnatural stressor, say gluten, fructose, tranquilizers, nail polish, or some such substance, by trial and error, is more robust than adding medication, with unknown side effects, unknown in spite of the statements about evidence and schmevidence. As you can see from graphic 1 of the PDF, the map uninhibitedly spreads across domains in human pursuits, such as culture, health, biology, political systems, technology, urban organization, socioeconomic life, and other matters of more or less direct interest to the listener. I have even managed to merge decision-making and flaneur in the same breath. So a simple method would lead us to both a risk-based political philosophy and medical decision-making. The triad in action. Note that fragile and anti-fragile here are relative terms, not quite absolute properties. One item to the right of the triad is more anti-fragile than another to the left. For instance, artisans are more anti-fragile than small businesses, but a rock star will be more anti-fragile than any artisan. Debt always puts you on the left, fragilizes economic systems. And things are anti-fragile up to a certain level of stress. Your body benefits from some amount of mishandling, but up to a point. It would not benefit too much from being thrown down from the top of the Tower of Babel. The golden robust. Further, the robust here in the middle column is not equivalent to Aristotle's golden middle, commonly mislabeled the golden mean, in the way that, say, generosity is the middle between profligacy and stinginess. It can be, but it is not necessarily so. Anti-fragility is desirable in general, but not always, as there are cases in which anti-fragility will be costly, extremely so. Further, it is hard to consider robustness as always desirable. To quote Nietzsche, one can die from being immortal. Finally, by now the listener, grappling with a new word, might ask too much from it. If the designation anti-fragile is rather vague and limited to specific sources of harm or volatility, and up to a certain range of exposure, it is no more and no less so than the designation fragile. Anti-fragility is relative to a given situation. A boxer might be robust, hale when it comes to his physical condition, and might improve from fight to fight, but he can easily be emotionally fragile and break into tears when dumped by his girlfriend. Your grandmother might have opposite qualities, fragile in build but equipped with a strong personality. I remember the following vivid image from the Lebanese Civil War. A diminutive old lady, a widow, she was dressed in black, was chastising militiamen from the enemy side for having caused the shattering of the glass in her window during a battle. They were pointing their guns at her. A single bullet would have terminated her, but they were visibly having a bad moment, intimidated and scared by her. She was the opposite of the boxer, physically fragile, but not fragile in character. Book 1. The Anti-Fragile, An Introduction. The first two chapters introduce and illustrate anti-fragility. Chapter 3 introduces a distinction between the organic and the mechanical, say, between your cat and a washing machine. Chapter 4 is about how the anti-fragility of some comes from the fragility of others, how errors benefit some, not others, the sort of things people tend to call evolution and write a lot about. Chapter 1 explains how we missed the word anti-fragility in classrooms. Fragile, robust, anti-fragile, as Damocles, Phoenix, Hydra. Domain dependence. Between Damocles and Hydra. Please cut my head off. How by some magic colors become colors. How to lift weight in Dubai. Half of life has no name. You are in the post office about to send a gift, a package full of champagne glasses, to a cousin in central Siberia. As the package can be damaged during transportation, you would stamp fragile, breakable, or handle with care on it, in red. Now, what is the exact opposite of such situation, the exact opposite of fragile? Almost all people answer that the opposite of fragile is robust, resilient, solid, or something of the sort. But the resilient, robust, and company are items that neither break nor improve, so you would not need to write anything on them. Have you ever seen a package with robust in thick green letters stamped on it? Logically, the exact opposite of a fragile parcel would be a package on which one has written, "Please mishandle," or "Please handle carelessly." Its contents would not just be unbreakable, but would benefit from shocks and a wide array of trauma. The fragile is the package that would be at best unharmed. The robust would be at best and at worst unharmed. And the opposite of fragile is therefore what is at worst unharmed. We gave the appellation anti-fragile to such a package. A neologism was necessary, as there is no simple non-compound word in the Oxford English Dictionary that expresses the point of reverse fragility. For the idea of anti-fragility is not part of our consciousness, but, luckily, it is part of our ancestral behavior, our biological apparatus, and a ubiquitous property of every system that has survived. To see how alien the concept is to our minds, repeat the experiment and ask around at the next gathering, picnic, or pre-riot congregation, what's the antonym of fragile? And specify insistently that you mean the exact reverse, something that has opposite properties and payoff. The likely answers will be, aside from robust, unbreakable, solid, well-built, resilient, strong, something-proof, say, waterproof, windproof, rustproof, unless they've heard of this book. Wrong. And it is not just individuals, but branches of knowledge that are confused by it. This is a mistake made in every dictionary of synonyms and antonyms I've found. Another way to view it. Since the opposite of positive is negative, not neutral, the opposite of positive fragility should be negative fragility. Hence my appellation, anti-fragility, not neutral, which would just convey robustness, strength, and unbreakability. Indeed, when one writes things down mathematically, anti-fragility is fragility with a negative sign in front of it. Just as concavity is convexity with a negative sign in front of it, and is sometimes called anti-convexity. This blind spot seems universal. There is no word for anti-fragility in the main known languages, modern, ancient, colloquial, or slang. Even Russian, Soviet version, and standard Brooklyn English don't seem to have a designation for anti-fragility, conflating it with robustness. I checked, in addition to Brooklyn English, most Indo-European languages, both ancient, Latin, Greek, and modern branches, Romance, Italian, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Slavic, Russian, Polish, Serbian, Croatian, Germanic, German, Dutch, Afrikaans, and Indo-Iranian, Hindu, Urdu, Farsi. It is also absent from non-Indo-European families such as Semitic, Arabic, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Turkic. Turkish. Half of life, the interesting half of life, we don't have a name for. Please behead me. If we have no common name for anti-fragility, we can find a mythological equivalence, the expression of historical intelligence through potent metaphors. In a Roman recycled version of a Greek myth, the Sicilian tyrant Dionysius II has the fawning courtier Damocles enjoy the luxury of a fancy banquet, but with a sword hanging over his head, tied to the ceiling with a single hair from a horse's tail. A horse's hair is the kind of thing that eventually breaks under pressure, followed by a scene of blood, high-pitched screams, and the equivalent of ancient ambulances. Damocles is fragile. It is only a matter of time before the sword strikes him down. In another ancient legend, this time the Greek recycling of an ancient Semitic and Egyptian legend, we find Phoenix, the bird with splendid colors. Whenever it is destroyed, it is reborn from its own ashes. It always returns to its initial state. Phoenix happens to be the ancient symbol of Beirut, the city where I grew up. According to legend, Berytus, Beirut's historical name, has been destroyed 7 times in its close to 5,000-year history, and has come back 7 times. The story seems cogent, as I myself saw the 8th episode. Central Beirut, the ancient part of the city, was completely destroyed for the 8th time during my late childhood, thanks to the brutal civil war. I also saw its 8th rebuilding. But Beirut was, in its latest version, rebuilt in even better shape than the previous incarnation, and with an interesting irony. The earthquake of A.D. 551 had buried the Roman law school, which was discovered, like a bonus from history, during the reconstruction. with archaeologists and real estate developers trading public insults. That's not Phoenix, but something else, beyond the robust. Which brings us to the third mythological metaphor, Hydra. Hydra, in Greek mythology, is a serpent-like creature that dwells in the Lake of Lerna, near Argos, and has numerous heads. Each time one is cut off, two grow back, so harm is what it likes. Hydra represents anti-fragility. The Sword of Damocles represents the side effect of power and success. You cannot rise and rule without facing this continuous danger. Someone out there will be actively working to topple you. And like the sword, the danger will be silent, inexorable, and discontinuous. It will fall abruptly after long periods of quiet, perhaps at the very moment one has gotten used to it and forgotten about its existence. Black swans will be out there to get you, as you now have much more to lose, a cost of success and growth, perhaps an unavoidable penalty of excessive success. At the end, what matters is the strength of the string, not the wealth and power of the dining party. But, luckily, this is an identifiable, measurable, and tractable vulnerability for those who want to listen. The entire point of the triad is that in many situations we can measure the strength of the string. Further, consider how toxic such growth followed by a fall can be to society, as the fall of the dining guest, in response to the fall of the Sword of Damocles, will bring what we now call collateral damage, harming others. For instance, the collapse of a large institution will have effects on society. Sophistication, a certain brand of sophistication, also brings fragility to black swans. As societies gain in complexity, with more and more cutting-edge sophistication in them, and more specialization, they become increasingly vulnerable to collapse. This idea has been brilliantly and convincingly adumbrated by the archaeologist Joseph Tainter. But it does not have to be so. It is so only for those unwilling to go the extra step and understand the matrix of reality. To counter success, you need a high offsetting dose of robustness, even high doses of anti-fragility. You want to be Phoenix, or possibly Hydra. Otherwise, the Sword of Damocles will get you. On the necessity of naming. We know more than we think we do, a lot more than we can articulate. If our formal systems of thought denigrate the natural, and in fact we don't have a name for anti-fragility, and fight the concept whenever we use our brains, it does not mean that our actions neglect it. Our perceptions and intuitions, as expressed in deeds, can be superior to what we know and tabulate, discuss in words, and teach in a classroom. We will have ample discussions of the point, particularly with the potent notion of the apophatic, what cannot be explicitly said or directly described in our current vocabulary. So for now, take this curious phenomenon. In Through the Language Glass, the linguist Guy Deutscher reports that many primitive populations, without being colorblind, have verbal designations for only two or three colors. But when given a simple test, they can successfully match strings to their corresponding colors. They are capable of detecting the differences between the various nuances of the rainbow, but they do not express these in their vocabularies. These populations are culturally, though not biologically, colorblind. Just as we are intellectually, not organically, anti-fragility blind. To see the difference, just consider that you need the name blue for the construction of a narrative, but not when you engage in action. It is not well known that many colors we take for granted had no name for a long time, and had no names in the central texts in Western culture. Ancient Mediterranean texts, both Greek and Semitic, also had a reduced vocabulary of a small number of colors polarized around the dark and the light. Homer and his contemporaries were limited to about three or four main colors, black, white, and some indeterminate part of the rainbow, often subsumed as red or yellow. I contacted Guy Deutscher. He was extremely generous with his help and pointed out to me that the ancients even lacked words for something as elementary as blue. This absence of the word blue in ancient Greek explains the recurring reference by Homer to the wine-dark sea, oinopa ponton, which has been quite puzzling to readers, including this one. Interestingly, it was the British Prime Minister William Gladstone who first made this discovery in the 1850s, and was unfairly and thoughtlessly reviled for it by the usual journalists. Gladstone, quite an erudite, wrote, during his interregnum between political positions, an impressive 1,700-page treatise on Homer. In the last section, Gladstone announced this limitation of color vocabulary, attributing our modern sensitization to many more nuances of color, to a cross-generational training of the eye. But regardless of these variations of color in the culture of the time, people were shown to be able to identify the nuances, unless physically colorblind. Gladstone was impressive in many respects. Aside from his erudition, force of character, respect for the weak, and high level of energy, four very attractive attributes, respect for the weak being, after intellectual courage, the second most attractive quality to this author, he showed remarkable prescience. He figured out what few in his day had dared to propose, that the Iliad corresponds to a true story. The city of Troy had not been discovered yet. In addition, even more prescient and of great relevance to this book, he was insistent upon a balanced fiscal budget. Fiscal deficits have proven to be a prime source of fragility in social and economic systems. Proto-antifragility. There have been names for two starter antifragility concepts, with two precursor applications that cover some special cases of it. These are mild aspects of antifragility and limited to the medical field, but they are a good way to start. According to legend, Mithridates IV, king of Pontus in Asia Minor, while hiding after his father's assassination, got himself some protection against poisoning by ingesting sublethal doses of toxic material in progressively larger quantities. He later incorporated the process into a complicated religious ritual. But this immunity got him in trouble a bit later, as his attempt to take his own life by poisoning failed, having fortified himself against the drugs of others. So he had to ask for the services of an ally military commander to give him a blow with a sword. The method named Antidotum Mithridatium, celebrated by Celsus, the ancient world's famous doctor, had to be rather fashionable in Rome, since about a century later it brought some complications to the Emperor Nero's attempts at matricide. Nero had been obsessed with the idea of killing his mother, Agrippina, who, to make things more colorful, was Caligula's sister, and even more colorful, was the alleged lover of the philosopher Seneca, more on whom later. But a mother tends to know her son rather well and predict his actions, particularly when he is her only child, and Agrippina knew something about poison, as she might have used the method to kill at least one of her husbands. I said things were quite colorful. So, suspecting that Nero had a contract on her, she got herself mithridatized against the poisons that would have been available to her son's underlings. Like Mithridates, Agrippina eventually died by more mechanical methods, as her son, supposedly, had assassins slay her, thus providing us with the small but meaningful lesson that one cannot be robust against everything. And 2,000 years later, nobody has found a method for us to get fortified against swords. Let us call mithridatization the result of an exposure to a small dose of a substance that, over time, makes one immune to additional, larger quantities of it. It is the sort of approach used in vaccination and allergy medicine. It is not quite antifragility, still at the more modest level of robustness, but we are on our way. And we already have a hint that perhaps being deprived of poison makes us fragile, and that the road to robustification starts with a modicum of harm. Now consider a case when the poisonous substance, in some dose, makes you better off overall, one step up from robustness. Hormesis, a word coined by pharmacologists, is when a small dose of a harmful substance is actually beneficial for the organism, acting as medicine. A little bit of an otherwise offending substance, not too much, acts to benefit the organism and make it better overall as it triggers some overreaction. This was not interpreted at the time in the sense of gains from harm, so much as harm is dose-dependent or medicine is dose-dependent. The interest to scientists has been in the non-linearity of the dose response. Hormesis was well known by the ancients, and like the color blue, was known but not expressed. but it was only in 1888 that it was first scientifically described, though still not given a name, by a German toxicologist, Hugo Schulz, who observed that small doses of poison stimulate the growth of yeast, while larger doses cause harm. Some researchers hold that the benefits of vegetables may not be so much in what we call the vitamins, or some other rationalizing theories, that is, ideas that seem to make sense in narrative form, but have not been subjected to rigorous empirical testing, but in the following. Plants protect themselves from harm and fend off predators with poisonous substances that, ingested by us in the right quantities, may stimulate our organisms. Or so goes the story. Again, limited, low-dose poisoning triggers healthy benefits. Many claim that caloric restriction, permanent or episodic, activates healthy reactions and switches that, among other benefits, lengthen life expectancy in laboratory animals. We humans live too long for researchers to test if such restriction increases our life expectancy. If the hypothesis is true, then the subjects of the test would outlive the researchers. But it looks like such restriction makes humans healthier and may also improve their sense of humor. But since abundance would bring the opposite effect, this episodic caloric restriction can also be interpreted as follows. Too much regular food is bad for you, and depriving humans of the stressor of hunger may make them live less than their full potential. So all hormesis seems to be doing is re-establishing the natural dosage for food and hunger in humans. In other words, hormesis is the norm, and its absence is what hurts us. Hormesis lost some scientific respect, interest, and practice after the 1930s because some people mistakenly associated it with homeopathy. The association was unfair, as the mechanisms are extremely different. Homeopathy is based on other principles, such as the one that minute, highly diluted parts of the agents of a disease, so small they can hardly be perceptible, hence cannot cause hormesis, can help cure us of the disease itself. Homeopathy has shown little empirical backing, and because of its testing methodologies, belongs today to alternative medicine, while hormesis, as a phenomenon, has ample scientific evidence to back it up. But the larger point is that we can now see that depriving systems of stressors, vital stressors, is not necessarily a good thing, and can be downright harmful. Domain independence is domain dependent. This idea that systems may need some stress and agitation has been missed by those who grasp it in one area and not in another. So we can now also see the domain dependence of our minds, a domain being an area or category of activity. Some people can understand an idea in one domain, say medicine, and fail to recognize it in another, say socioeconomic life. Or they get it in the classroom, but not in the more complicated texture of the street. Humans somehow fail to recognize situations outside the contexts in which they usually learn about them. I had a vivid illustration of domain dependence in the driveway of a hotel in the pseudo-city of Dubai. A fellow who looked like a banker had a uniformed porter carry his luggage. I can instantly tell if someone is a certain type of banker with minimal cues, as I have physical allergies to them, even affecting my breathing. About 15 minutes later, I saw the banker lifting free weights at the gym, trying to replicate natural exercise, using kettlebells as if he were swinging a suitcase. Domain dependence is pervasive. Further, the problem is not just that mithridatization and hormesis can be known in some medical circles and missed in other applications, such as socioeconomic life. Even within medicine, some get it here and miss it there. The same doctor might recommend exercise so you get tougher, and a few minutes later write a prescription for antibiotics in response to a trivial infection so you don't get sick. Another expression of domain dependence. Ask a U.S. citizen if some semi-governmental agency with a great deal of independence and no interference from Congress should control the price of cars, morning newspapers, and Malbec wine as its domain of specialty. He would jump in anger, as it appears to violate every principle the country stands for, and call you a communist post-Soviet mole for even suggesting it. Okay. Then ask him if that same government agency should control foreign exchange, mainly the rate of the dollar against the euro and the Mongolian Tigrit. Same reaction. This is not France. Then, very gently point out to him that the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States is in the business of controlling and managing the price of another good, another price, called the lending rate, the interest rate in the economy, and has proved to be good at it. The Libertarian presidential candidate Ron Paul was called a crank for suggesting the abolition of the Federal Reserve, or even restricting its role. But he would also have been called a crank for suggesting the creation of an agency to control other prices. Imagine someone gifted in learning languages, but unable to transfer concepts from one tongue to another. So he would need to relearn chair, or love, or apple pie every time he acquires a new language. He would not recognize house, English, or casa, Spanish, or bait, Semitic. We are all, in a way, similarly handicapped. Unable to recognize the same idea when it is presented in a different context. It is as if we are doomed to be deceived by the most superficial part of things, the packaging, the gift wrapping. This is why we don't see anti-fragility in places that are obvious, too obvious. It is not part of the accepted way of thinking about success, economic growth, or innovation that these may result only from overcompensation against stressors. Nor do we see this overcompensation at work elsewhere. And domain dependence is also why it has been difficult for many researchers to realize that uncertainty, incomplete understanding, disorder, and volatility are members of the same close family. This lack of translation is a mental handicap that comes with being a human. And we will only start to attain wisdom or rationality when we make an effort to overcome and break through it. Let us get deeper into overcompensation. Chapter 2. Where we find overcompensation. Obsessive love is the most anti-fragile thing outside of economics. Touristification and attempts to suck volatility out of life. Annealing inside and outside physics. Overcompensation and overreaction everywhere. Is it easy to write on a Heathrow runway? Try to get the Pope to ban your work. How to beat up an economist, but not too hard, just enough to go to jail. My own domain dependence was revealed to me one day as I was sitting in the office of David Halpern, a UK government advisor and policymaker. He informed me, in response to the idea of anti-fragility, of a phenomenon called post-traumatic growth. The opposite of post-traumatic stress syndrome, by which people harmed by past events surpass themselves. I had never heard about it before, and, to my great shame, had never made the effort to think of its existence. There is a small literature, but it is not advertised outside a narrow discipline. We hear about the more lurid post-traumatic disorder, not post-traumatic growth, in the intellectual and so-called learned vocabulary. But popular culture has an awareness of its equivalent, revealed in the expression, it builds character. So do the ancient Mediterranean classics, along with grandmothers. Intellectuals tend to focus on negative responses from randomness, fragility, rather than the positive ones, anti-fragility. This is not just in psychology. It prevails across the board. How do you innovate? First, try to get in trouble. I mean serious but not terminal trouble. I hold, it is beyond speculation, rather a conviction, that innovation and sophistication spark from initial situations of necessity in ways that go far beyond the satisfaction of such necessity, from the unintended side effects of, say, an initial invention or attempted invention. Naturally, there are classical thoughts on the subject, with a Latin saying that sophistication is born out of hunger, Artificia docuit fames. The idea pervades classical literature. In Ovid, difficulty is what wakes up the genius, ingenia mala sipe movent, which translates in Brooklyn English into when life gives you a lemon. The excess energy released from overreaction to setbacks is what innovates. This message from the ancients is vastly deeper than it seems. It contradicts modern methods and ideas of innovation and progress on many levels, as we tend to think that innovation comes from bureaucratic funding, through planning, or by putting people through a Harvard Business School class by one highly decorated professor of innovation and entrepreneurship, who never innovated anything, or hiring a consultant, who never innovated anything. This is a fallacy. Note for now the disproportionate contribution of uneducated technicians and entrepreneurs to various technological leaps, from the Industrial Revolution to the emergence of Silicon Valley, and you will see what I mean. Yet in spite of the visibility of the counter-evidence and the wisdom you can pick up free of charge from the ancients, or grandmothers, moderns try today to create inventions from situations of comfort, safety, and predictability, instead of accepting the notion that necessity really is the mother of invention. Many, like the great Roman statesman Cato the Censor, looked at comfort, almost any form of comfort, as a road to waste. Cato was the statesman who, 3 books ago, in Fooled by Randomness, expelled all philosophers from Rome. He did not like it when we had it too easy, as he worried about the weakening of the will. And the softening he feared was not just at the personal level. An entire society can fall ill. Consider that as I am writing these lines, we are living in a debt crisis. The world as a whole has never been richer, and it has never been more heavily in debt, living off borrowed money. The record shows that, for society, the richer we become, the harder it gets to live within our means. Abundance is harder for us to handle than scarcity. Cato would have smiled, hearing about the recently observed effect in aeronautics, that the automation of airplanes is under-challenging pilots, making flying too comfortable for them, dangerously comfortable. The dulling of the pilot's attention and skills from too little challenge is indeed causing deaths from flying accidents. Part of the problem is a Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, regulation that forced the industry to increase its reliance on automated flying. But, thankfully, the same FAA finally figured out the problem. It has recently found that pilots often abdicate too much responsibility to automated systems. How to win a horse race. It is said that the best horses lose when they compete with slower ones and win against better rivals. Undercompensation from the absence of a stressor, inverse hormesis, absence of challenge, degrades the best of the best. In Baudelaire's poem, the albatross's giant wings prevent him from walking. Many do better in Calculus 103 than Calculus 101. This mechanism of overcompensation hides in the most unlikely places. If tired after an intercontinental flight, go to the gym for some exertion instead of resting. Also, it is a well-known trick that if you need something urgently done, give the task to the busiest or second busiest person in the office. Most humans manage to squander their free time, as free time makes them dysfunctional, lazy, and unmotivated. The busier they get, the more active they are at other tasks. Overcompensation here again. I've discovered a trick when giving lectures. I have been told by conference organizers that one needs to be clear, to speak with the fake articulation of TV announcers, maybe even dance on the stage to get the attention of the crowd. Some try sending authors to speech school. The first time it was suggested to me, I walked out, resolved to change publishers on the spot. I find it better to whisper, not shout. Better to be slightly inaudible, less clear. When I was a pit trader, one of those crazy people who stand in a crowded arena shouting and screaming in a continuous auction, I learned that the noise produced by the person is inverse to the pecking order. As with mafia dons, the most powerful traders were the least audible. One should have enough self-control to make the audience work hard to listen, which causes them to switch into intellectual overdrive. This paradox of attention has been a little bit investigated. There is empirical evidence of the effect of disfluency. Mental effort moves us into higher gear, activating more vigorous and more analytical brain machinery. This little bit of effort seems to activate the switch between two distinct mental systems, one intuitive and the other analytical. What psychologists call System 1 and System 2. The management guru Peter Drucker and the psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan two persons who mesmerized the crowds the most in their respective areas were the antithesis of the polished, swanky speaker or the consonant-trained television announcer. The same or a similar mechanism of overcompensation makes us concentrate better in the presence of a modicum of background random noise, as if the act of countering such noise helps us hone our mental focus. Consider this remarkable ability humans have to filter out noise at happy hour and distinguish the signal among so many other loud conversations. So not only are we made to overcompensate, but we sometimes need the noise. Like many writers, I like to sit in cafes, working, as they say, against resistance. Consider our bedtime predilection for the rustle of tree leaves or the sound of the ocean. There are even electric contraptions that produce white noise that helps people sleep better. There is nothing particularly white in white noise. It is simply random noise that follows a normal distribution. Now, these small distractions, like hormetic responses, act up to a point. I haven't tried it yet, but I am certain that it would be hard to write an essay on the runway of Heathrow Airport. Antifragile responses as redundancy. Something flashed when I heard post-traumatic during that London visit. It hit me right there and then that these antifragile hormetic responses were just a form of redundancy, and all the ideas of Mother Nature converged in my mind. It is all about redundancy. Nature likes to over-insure itself. Layers of redundancy are the central risk management property of natural systems. We humans have two kidneys. This may even include accountants. Extra spare parts and extra capacity in many, many things, say lungs, neural system, arterial apparatus, while human design tends to be spare and inversely redundant, so to speak. We have a historical track record of engaging in debt, which is the opposite of redundancy. $50,000 in extra cash in the bank, or better, under the mattress, is redundancy. Owing the bank an equivalent amount, that is, debt, is the opposite of redundancy. Redundancy is ambiguous because it seems like a waste if nothing unusual happens, except that something unusual happens, usually. Further, redundancy is not necessarily wussy. It can be extremely aggressive. For instance, if you have extra inventory of, say, fertilizers in the warehouse, just to be safe, and there happens to be a shortage because of disruptions in China, you can sell the excess inventory at a huge premium. Or if you have extra oil reserves, you may sell them at a large profit during a squeeze. Now, it turns out, the same, very same logic applies to overcompensation. It is just a form of redundancy. An additional head for Hydra is no different from an extra, that is, seemingly redundant, kidney for humans, and no different from the additional capacity to withstand an extra stressor. If you ingest, say, 15 milligrams of a poisonous substance, your body may prepare for 20 or more, and as a side effect, will get stronger overall. These extra 5 milligrams of poison that you can withstand are no different from additional stockpiles of vital or necessary goods, say, extra cash in the bank, or more food in the basement. And to return to the drivers of innovation, the additional quantities of motivation and willpower, so to speak, stemming from setbacks can be also seen as extra capacity. No different from extra boxes of victuals. A system that overcompensates is necessarily in overshooting mode. Building extra capacity and strength in anticipation of a worse outcome and in response to information about the possibility of a hazard. And of course, such extra capacity or strength may become useful by itself, opportunistically. We saw that redundancy is opportunistic. So such extra strength can be used to some benefit, even in the absence of the hazard. Tell the next MBA analyst or business school professor you run into that redundancy is not defensive. It is more like investment than insurance. And tell them that what they call inefficient is often very efficient. Indeed, our bodies discover probabilities in a very sophisticated manner and assess risks much better than our intellects do. To take one example, risk management professionals look in the past for information on the so-called worst-case scenario and use it to estimate future risks. This method is called stress testing. They take the worst historical recession, the worst war, the worst historical move in interest rates, or the worst point in unemployment as an exact estimate for the worst future outcome. but they never notice the following inconsistency. This so-called worst-case event, when it happened, exceeded the worst case at the time. I have called this mental defect the Lucretius problem, after the Latin poetic philosopher who wrote that the fool believes that the tallest mountain in the world will be equal to the tallest one he has observed. We consider the biggest object of any kind that we have seen in our lives or hear about as the largest item that can possibly exist, and we have been doing this for millennia. In pharaonic Egypt, which happens to be the first complete top-down nation-state managed by bureaucrats, scribes tracked the high water mark of the Nile and used it as an estimate for a future worst-case scenario. The same can be seen in the Fukushima nuclear reactor, which experienced a catastrophic failure in 2011 when a tsunami struck. It had been built to withstand the worst past historical earthquake, with the builders not imagining much worse, and not thinking that the worst past event had to be a surprise, as it had no precedent. Likewise, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Fragilista Dr. Alan Greenspan, in his apology to Congress, offered the classic, "It never happened before." Well, nature, unlike Fragilista Greenspan, prepares for what has not happened before, assuming worse harm is possible. The obvious has not been tested empirically. Can the occurrence of extreme events be predicted from past history? Alas, according to a simple test, no. Sorry. If humans fight the last war, nature fights the next one. Your body is more imaginative about the future than you are. Consider how people train in weightlifting. The body overshoots in response to exposures and overprepares, up to the point of biological limit, of course. This is how bodies get stronger. In the aftermath of the banking crisis, I received all manner of threats, and the Wall Street Journal suggested that I stock up on bodyguards. I tried to tell myself, no worries, stay calm. These threats were coming from disgruntled bankers. Anyway, people get whacked first, then you read about it in the newspapers, not in the reverse sequence. But the argument did not register in my mind, and when in New York or London, I could not relax, even after chamomile tea. I started feeling paranoia in public places, scrutinizing people to ascertain that I was not being followed. I started taking the bodyguard suggestion seriously, and I found it more appealing and considerably more economical to become one, or better, to look like one. I found Lenny Cake, a trainer, weighing around 280 pounds, 130 kilograms, who moonlighted as a security person. His nickname and weight both came from his predilection for cakes. Lenny Cake was the most physically intimidating person within 5 zip codes, and he was 60. So, rather than taking lessons, I watched him train. He was into the maximum lifts type of training and swore by it, as he found it the most effective and least time-consuming. This method consisted of short episodes in the gym in which one focused solely on improving one's past maximum in a single lift, the heaviest weight one could haul, sort of the high water mark. The workout was limited to trying to exceed that mark once or twice, rather than spending time on unentertaining, time-consuming repetitions. The exercise got me into a naturalistic form of weightlifting, and one that accords with the evidence-based literature. Work on the maximum, spend the rest of the time resting and splurging on mafia-sized steaks. I have been trying to push my limit for 4 years now. It is amazing to see how something in my biology anticipates a higher level than the past maximum until it reaches its ceiling. When I deadlift, that is, mimic lifting a stone to waist level, using a bar with 330 pounds, then rest, I can safely expect that I will build a certain amount of additional strength as my body predicts that next time I may need to lift 335 pounds. The benefits, beyond the fading of my paranoia and my newfound calm in public places, include small unexpected conveniences. When I am harassed by limo drivers in the arrival hall at Kennedy Airport insistently offering me a ride and I calmly tell them to f*** off, they go away immediately. But there are severe drawbacks. Some of the readers I meet at conferences have a rough time dealing with an intellectual who has the appearance of a bodyguard. Intellectuals can be svelte or flabby and out of shape when they wear a tweed jacket, but they are not supposed to look like butchers. Something that will give the Darwinists some work, an observation made to me by a risk analyst, my favorite intellectual opponent and personal friend, Aaron Brown. The term fitness itself may be quite imprecise and even ambiguous, which is why the notion of anti-fragility as something exceeding mere fitness can elucidate the confusion. What does fitness mean? Being exactly tuned to a given past history of a specific environment, or extrapolating to an environment with stressors of higher intensity? Many seem to point to the first kind of adaptation, missing the notion of anti-fragility. But if one were to write down mathematically a standard model of selection, one would get overcompensation rather than mere fitness. Even the psychologists who studied the anti-fragile response of post-traumatic growth and show the data for it don't quite get the full concept, as they lapse, when using words, into the concept of resilience. On the anti-fragility of riots, love, and other unexpected beneficiaries of stress. Once one makes an effort to overcome domain dependence, the phenomenon of overcompensation appears ubiquitous. Those who understand bacterial resistance in the biological domain completely fail to grasp the dictum by Seneca in De Clemencia about the inverse effect of punishments. He wrote, "Repeated punishment, while it crushes the hatred of a few, stirs the hatred of all, just as trees that have been trimmed throw out again countless branches. For revolutions feed on repression, growing heads faster and faster as one literally cuts a few off by killing demonstrators. There is an Irish revolutionary song that encapsulates the effect. The higher you build your barricades, the stronger we become. The crowds, at some point, mutate, blinded by anger and a sense of outrage, fueled by the heroism of a few willing to sacrifice their lives for the cause, although they don't quite see it as sacrifice, and hungry for the privilege to become martyrs. It is that political movements and rebellions can be highly anti-fragile, and the sucker games to try to repress them using brute force rather than manipulate them, give in, or find more astute ruses, as Heracles did with Hydra. If anti-fragility is what wakes up and overreacts and overcompensates to stressors and damage, then one of the most anti-fragile things you will find outside economic life is a certain brand of refractory love or hate. One that seems to overreact and overcompensate for impediments such as distance, family incompatibilities, and every conscious attempt to kill it. Literature is rife with characters trapped in a form of anti-fragile passion, seemingly against their will. In Proust's long novel La Recherche, Swan, a socially sophisticated Jewish art dealer, falls for Odette, a demi-mondaine, a kept woman of sorts, a semi, or perhaps just a quarter, prostitute. She treats him badly. Her elusive behavior fuels his obsession, causing him to demean himself for the reward of a bit more time with her. He exhibits overt clinginess, follows her on her trysts with other men, hiding shamelessly in staircases, which of course causes her to treat him even more elusively. Supposedly, the story was a fictionalization of Proust's own entanglement with his male driver. Or take Dino Buzzati's semi-autobiographical novel Un Amore, the story of a middle-aged Milanese man who falls, accidentally of course, for a dancer at the Scala who moonlights as a prostitute. She of course mistreats him, exploits him, takes advantage of him, milks him, and the more she mistreats him, the more he exposes himself to abuse to satisfy the anti-fragile thirst of a few moments with her. But some form of happy ending there. From his biography, Buzzati himself ended up marrying, at 60, a 25-year-old, Almerina, a former dancer, seemingly the character of the story. When he died shortly after that, she became a good caretaker of his literary legacy. Even when authors such as Lucretius, the same of the High Mountains earlier in this chapter, rant against the dependence, imprisonment, and alienation of love, treating it as a preventable disease, they end up lying to us or themselves. Legend, perhaps. Lucretius, the priest of anti-romance, might have been himself involved in uncontrollable, anti-fragile, infatuation. Like tormenting love, some thoughts are so anti-fragile that you feed them by trying to get rid of them, turning them into obsessions. Psychologists have shown the irony of the process of thought control. the more energy you put into trying to control your ideas and what you think about, the more your ideas end up controlling you. Please ban my book, The Anti-Fragility of Information. Information is anti-fragile. It feeds more on attempts to harm it than it does on efforts to promote it. For instance, many wreck their reputations merely by trying to defend it. The wily Venetians knew how to spread information by disguising it as a secret. Try it out with the following experiment in spreading gossip. Tell someone a secret and qualify it by insisting that it is a secret, begging your listener not to tell anyone. The more you insist that it remain a secret, the more it will spread. We all learn early on in life that books and ideas are anti-fragile and get nourishment from attacks. To borrow from the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, one of the doer Stoic authors, fire feeds on obstacles. There is the attraction of banned books, their anti-fragility to interdicts. The first book I read during my childhood of Graham Greene's was The Power and the Glory, selected for no other reason than its having been put on the index, that is, banned, by the Vatican. Likewise, as a teenager, I gorged on the books of the American expatriate Henry Miller. His major book sold 1 million copies in 1 year, thanks to having been banned in 23 states. The same with Madame Bovary or Lady Chatterley's Lover. Criticism for a book is a truthful, unfaked badge of attention, signaling that it is not boring. And boring is the only very bad thing for a book. Consider the Ayn Rand phenomenon. Her books, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, have been read for more than half a century by millions of people in spite of, or more likely thanks to, brutally nasty reviews and attempts to discredit her. The first order information is the intensity. What matters is the effort the critic puts into trying to prevent others from reading the book, or, more generally in life, it is the effort in bad-mouthing someone that matters, not so much what is said. So if you really want people to read a book, tell them it is overrated, with a sense of outrage, and use the attribute underrated for the opposite effect. Balzac recounts how actresses paid journalists, often in kind, to write favorable accounts, but the wiliest got them to write unfavorable comments, knowing that it made them more interesting. I have just bought Tom Holland's book on the rise of Islam for the sole reason that he was attacked by Glenn Bowersock, considered to be the most prominent living scholar on the Roman Levant. Until then, I had thought that Tom Holland was just a popularizer, and I would not have taken him seriously otherwise. I didn't even attempt to read Bowersock's review. So here is a simple rule of thumb, a heuristic. To estimate the quality of research, take the caliber of the highest detractor or the caliber of the lowest detractor, whom the author answers in print, whichever is lower. Criticism itself can be anti-fragile to repression, when the fault finder wants to be attacked in return in order to get some validation. Jean Ferrand, said to be a very envious thinker, with the mediocrity of envious thinkers, managed to play a role in intellectual history solely by irritating the otherwise brilliant Voltaire to the point of bringing him to write satirical poems against him. Voltaire, himself a gadfly and expert at ticking off people to benefit from their reactions, forgot how things worked when it came to himself. Perhaps Voltaire's charm was in that he did not know how to save his wit. So the same hidden anti-fragilities apply to attacks on our ideas and persons. We fear them and dislike negative publicity, but smear campaigns, if you can survive them, help enormously, conditional on the person appearing to be extremely motivated and adequately angry, just as when you hear a woman bad-mouthing another in front of a man, or vice versa. There is a visible selection bias. Why did he attack you instead of someone else, one of the millions of persons deserving but not worthy of attack? It is his energy in attacking or bad-mouthing that will, anti-fragile style, put you on the map. My great-grandfather Nicholas Olson was a wily politician who managed to stay permanently in power and hold government positions in spite of his numerous enemies, most notably his archenemy, my great-great-grandfather on the Taleb side of the family. As my grandfather, his eldest son, was starting his administrative and hopefully political career, his father summoned him to his deathbed. "My son, I am very disappointed in you," he said. "I never hear anything wrong said about you. You have proven yourself incapable of generating envy. Get another job. As we saw with the Voltaire story, it is not possible to stamp out criticism. If it harms you, get out. It is easier to change jobs than control your reputation or public perception. Some jobs and professions are fragile to reputational harm, something that in the age of the Internet cannot possibly be controlled. These jobs aren't worth having. You do not want to control your reputation. You won't be able to do it by controlling information flow. Instead, focus on altering your exposure, say, by putting yourself in a position impervious to reputational damage, or even put yourself in a situation to benefit from the anti-fragility of information. In that sense, a writer is anti-fragile, but we will see later most modernistic professions are usually not. I was in Milan trying to explain anti-fragility to Luca Formenton, my Italian publisher, with great aid from body language and hand gestures. I was there partly for the Moscato dessert wines, partly for a convention in which the other main speaker was a famous fragilista economist. So suddenly remembering that I was an author, I presented Luca with the following thought experiment. If I beat up the economist publicly, what would happen to me? Other than a publicized trial causing great interest in the new notions of fragilista and anti-fragilista. You know, this economist had what is called a tête à baf, a face that invites you to slap it, just like a cannoli invites you to bite into it. Luca thought for a second. Well, it's not like he would like me to do it, but, you know, it wouldn't hurt book sales. Nothing I can do as an author that makes it to the front page of Corriere della Sera would be detrimental for my book. Almost no scandal would hurt an artist or writer. The French have a long series of authors who owe part of their status to their criminal record, which includes the poet Ronsard, the writer Jean Genet, and many others. Now let's say I were a mid-level executive employee of some corporation listed on the London Stock Exchange, the sort who never take chances by dressing down, always wearing a suit and tie, even on the beach. What would happen to me if I attack the fragilista? My firing and arrest record would plague me forever. I would be the total victim of informational anti-fragility. But someone earning close to minimum wage, say, a construction worker or a taxi driver, does not overly depend on his reputation and is free to have his own opinions. He would be merely robust compared to the artist, who is anti-fragile. A mid-level bank employee with a mortgage would be fragile to the extreme. In fact, he would be completely a prisoner of the value system that invites him to be corrupt to the core because of his dependence on the annual vacation in Barbados. The same with a civil servant in